This is not an official podcast of the National Society Daughters of the American Revolution, NSDAR, and does not necessarily represent the position of the NSDAR. This interview is being conducted for the Daughter Dialogues Oral History Project. The interviewer is Risha Rainey. The narrator is Dawn Dance. Dawn, how old are you?
I am 56 years old.
Where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles.
Tell me about your parents. Where are they from, and did they work when you were growing up?
Well, my mother was from Mississippi, past Christian Mississippi, and she was a stay-at-home mother. And my father was from Brooklyn, New York, and he worked for Caltrans and as an engineer, and also had a second job while we were growing up so my mother could stay at home. And he worked at the Broadway department store selling shoes in the evenings.
What type of engineer?
A civil transportation engineer for Caltrans.
And did he hold any other jobs?
He also would do reserves, military reserves. So he would have that 1 week in a month and 2 weeks a year where he would be gone to bring in extra money.
Tell me about your upbringing. As a child, did you have siblings?
I have had an older brother named Lauren, who is no longer with us, and an older sister, Robin, and a younger sister, Erica. I have a lot of fond memories growing up in Los Angeles. A lot of activities, you know, days at the beaches or going to the zoo and things like that.
Tell me one of your strongest memories of childhood.
As an adult, thinking of all the things we did when I was a child, I just admire my parents because I know that I haven't been able to equal that. Got family camping trips. We always loved camping. And of course, the wonderful thing about that was Dad was there the whole time. Every now and then, there would be a surprise drive to the beach in the evening. And that was always fun, just to look at the stars and the waves crashing. And of course, the number one thing I remember about being a child is every Halloween, no matter how tired my father was, after we went trick-or-treating, there was, I think it was Union, an oil tanker that they would paint and make look like the Great Pumpkin, and they'd give out candy there. So we would drive and go see the Great Pumpkin.
Did you also watch Charlie Brown, the Great Pumpkin Patch, I believe is the name of the cartoon?
Oh, of course. Charlie Brown, any of those. I enjoyed all those classic ones as a child. As a matter of fact, in one of the things in my parenting I do is there's strict rules about no holiday movies during those non-seasons, because there's no way to have that wonderful built-up anticipation that we had as a child, knowing this was the one time that was going to come on and you had to catch it. And when it was over for a whole nother year. It's hard to explain that these days to kids who can watch things on demand.
What type of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, when I was little, and probably looking through my school photos, it shows the most. There was something, my mother always referred to it as white flight, where, you know, kindergarten, it seemed like it was a really somewhat racially diverse area in Inglewood. And then you could just see as every year goes by that, you know, until fifth grade, when I'm the white child at school, because all the white people moved away and it was a predominantly black neighborhood.
Wait, you just said that you're the white child at school. Do you consider yourself white?
I do not consider myself white, but one of the names I used to get called at school was the honky.
Tell me about that. Why? How did that come about?
Because I am mixed race, but I'm part black and I am, I guess you call light skinned. So as a child in the playground, when, you know, kids just have to find something, that was one of the things I used to get called because I was much lighter than the rest of the kids. So I was the honky.
How did you feel about that?
Both spectrums in my life. It was weird, you know, because I didn't consider myself white. I knew I was mixed race. I knew that there was this family heritage of being Creole, even if I didn't understand what it was. But I wasn't like them. And I think that was what they were pointing out to me.
What ethnicities are your parents?
My father is, well, they both consider themselves Creole. My father is a mix of French, Spanish, and Black from Louisiana. And my mother is as well. She is, well, there's the knowledge I had as a child or what I know now after doing Ancestry DNA. She is Indian, Black, and Caucasian, mostly French. And of course, you know, it was that lore that there was Indian in our family, so many people here.
So they both considered themselves Creole, although she was born in Mississippi and your father was born in New York?
Correct.
Was the Creole community not kind of contained in Louisiana?
That is part of what had me very confused as a child, because I knew that Creoles were from Louisiana, but Dad was born in New York, and we didn't really talk about these things. We didn't talk about, you know, other than gumbo and, you know, going to Pete's to get his Louisiana hot sausage. It wasn't a huge part of my identity. It's not like I went around to other kids in school saying, I'm not a honky, I'm Creole. We just knew that that had to do with Louisiana and gumbo, and I don't know, it wasn't emphasized.
So you grew up considering yourself Black?
I grew up considering myself confused. You know, from coming from the South, dealing with all the Jim Crow thing, I think there was this desire of my mother's to have us pass. But if you look at me, it's obvious that I am not white, that there's something more going on. Back in the day before it was politically incorrect to ask people, I get people all the time asking me, you know, what are you? Because it is such an unusual mixture. So I didn't consider myself Black. I didn't consider myself white, but I knew that the emphasis should be on Indian or anything else but Black, if that makes sense. And I think that was just some preconceived notions my mom had to assimilate into, that life would be easier if her kids could pass. And I don't disparage my mother for that because I didn't live in her world. But it did make for, and it didn't give a lot of pride. You know, there was no be proud of who you are. I've been told that my grandmother's family was not very happy that she married my grandfather because he was dark. Yeah, unfortunately, some of the racist people I know are people that are not white. My mom, she's got half sisters. Her mother married a Black man after, or more Black man, I guess I should say, after my mom's father died. So her half siblings are Black. And I went to see my aunt about 10 years ago, and I hadn't seen her for a long time, and we start talking about Mom. She looks at me and says, you ever heard of this movie called An Imitation of Life? And I just started laughing. But I understand why Mom wanted us to try to pass for white from her point of view. But we don't look white. And it just, I don't know. It's taken years. But I love the term women of color, because, you know, people will say, well, aren't you black? Well, I'm part black. You start getting into justifying this, like, it sounds racist. You want to let people know it's just part of you. I don't have a problem being black, but I'm also white. I'm also this, that, and the other. Why should I deny those? Women of color are women of color. It covers everything. And it's a great description.
How do you check the box?
Today?
I didn't even have to explain that question, did I? You understand what the question means. Yes. Well, let's start with back then. Once you became old enough to fill out forms yourself, how did you check the box?
Once other became available, that was what I checked. Or my favorite, check as many as you need. And then, you know, I go with the African-American and Caucasian and Indian and Hispanic and, you know, because it's all there. Even before I did DNA, you know, I kind of knew it was all there.
Before other was available or an option and you could only check one box, which box would you check?
Good heavens. I don't know. If it was my mother, she probably put white. But being, I didn't identify with either. It's very odd being nothing. Does that make sense?
Yes, nothing is a strong word. Did you ever feel that kind of way? Is that sort of how you felt?
That I didn't belong in either world?
Did you feel like you personally were nothing? That's an interesting word that you chose. Was that ever anything that you felt about yourself?
I would say that the lack of pride in my ethnicity probably has contributed to struggling with self-esteem issues. But I'm a grown-up now, and I am responsible for what box I check and the pride I want to feel in who I am. And that's what I work on now.
Growing up, were you able to navigate that? You were being called a honky and by your black classmates. How did you deal with that? And did that continue throughout your childhood?
That continued throughout my childhood until we moved. And how I dealt with it, I mean, you know, they're just, I knew that I was different from them. And that was just their way of pointing it out or making fun of me. I mean, kids have all sorts of ways they make fun of each other. When I was a child, I had straight hair. So there was that aspect too, that, you know, I had the good hair. I think it caused me to keep to myself a lot in that situation, or to hang out with the few other white kids.
You said you moved, so I assume this was happening in the Los Angeles area?
Yes.
And then you moved where and at what age?
When I was 10, we moved to the San Fernando Valley for a couple of years, which was more ethnically diverse, and it wasn't an issue that I recall. But I think at that point, I already had that kind of keeping to myself. I don't know. Being teased and harassed just isn't fun.
Did you move again?
We did. And that's where I went to the other end of the spectrum. as in 77, we moved to the small town of Cameron Park in Northern California, and it was 99.9% white, and it was one of those things that I still wonder what the heck my dad was thinking.
How did you fit in, or did you fit in?
I didn't fit in initially. There was the first day of school at my middle school when five people came up to ask me if I was Black, and two of them used the N-word, and the other three used Negro, which, you know, in 77, that people weren't using that either. It was just, it was weird. It was very odd. Because, like I said, as a child, I've gone from being the honky to the N-word with my classmates.
It was. How did you feel this time when you were being called the N-word and you're on the opposite end of the spectrum, as you mentioned?
I remember thinking, what the heck has Dad done? And I don't judge him too harshly for that either. He had a dream. He bought some property. He wanted to build this big, beautiful house up here. He had a friend that worked for Caltrans that really told him it would be great. And, you know, can transfer up there and our kids can play together. And, you know, the only thing was this other person was white, and his blonde-haired, blue-eyed kids, I'm sure, did really well up here. And it wasn't just the racial part of being in Cameron Park. When I lived in L.A., even in the Valley, there's a great bus system. You can get from here to there. And I was allowed on occasion to take the bus. Like, I had a friend in Tarzana, and I remember taking the bus once to spend the night at her house. And when we went to Cameron Park, there was no public transportation. Nothing was in walking distance. It was very isolating. And my mother did not drive.
Were you involved in any extracurricular activities in school?
Once again, the issue of transportation comes into play. There was a school bus that would take us to school and take us home, but that did not include extracurriculars. My mother did not drive. My father worked out of town a lot, which was another way he had of making a little extra money. I did some college. That was, once again, very difficult. The transportation issue up there was huge. Trying to find a job that would allow me to have the money to get a car and allow me to go to school, it wasn't something easily done. And I moved to Sacramento, down in the Valley, became a flatlander for a little while because the percentage of jobs down here and the ethnic makeup of people in the Valley was much different. But then it was too far to drive home, and trying to get an apartment and go to school. I remember my French teacher waking me up in the middle of class one day, and I said, I just worked the graveyard shift, and he just let me go back to sleep.
This was in college?
Yes.
What college did you attend?
Just the local community college, American River College, not successfully.
What were you planning to study or endeavor to do with your education?
I've always been a science nerd. I would have really liked to have gone into medicine or into the sciences, but that did not pan out.
What prohibited you? Was it that issue you were talking about, is how am I going to get to class and get a job and work?
That was part of it. There were obstacles, but one of the biggest ones, and I wish I would have found out sooner, is when I was 30, I found out that I was a non-cataplectic narcoleptic, which is why school had been so hard, despite the fact of how intelligent I was, because I would go into class and I couldn't stay awake.
So explain to me that particular classification of narcolepsy.
Some people, when they hear narcolepsy, they think of seeing something on a movie where somebody laughs and they collapse. That extreme emotion and then losing all muscle function is called cataplexy. And the people who have cataplexy actually are a little more fortunate because that's easily diagnosed. I mean, if you start laughing or crying and you collapse, you're going to go to the doctor and say something is not right. For those of us who do not have cataplexy, we are what they call having excessive daytime sleepiness. I read once somebody describe having narcolepsy is like getting up in the morning and taking a sleeping pill and going about your day. And that's a pretty good analogy. When I was in high school, it didn't interfere all that much because there's a certain amount of stimulation you get joking with your classmates and things. But once I went to college and I didn't know anybody and there wasn't that other stimulation to try to help me stay awake, I was unable to function well in class. And it took 10 more years to find out what the problem was.
Wow. How did you end up finding out what it was? What was the tipping point that made you either go to the doctor specifically for it or that rendered a diagnosis?
I had gone to the doctor when I was 25 about it because there's other symptoms of narcolepsy. And I had gone to him about those. And the doctor was very rude and gave me a brief diagnosis for those two things. And that's hypnagogic hallucinations and sleep paralysis. That is when you're going to sleep or waking up and you're unable to move, but you're seeing and hearing and sometimes feeling things that are hallucinations. And it basically what it is you're dreaming, but you're still somewhat awake, which is what the hallucinations are. And he diagnosed those two things, but he did not bother to ask me if I felt that I was more tired than other people, which pretty much would have, you know, I would have answered yes. When I was 29, I was going to school for medical assisting, and we had to do a report on ourselves and reveal something. And I was looking up these two things, the hypnagogic hallucinations and sleep paralysis, getting more information to do my report. And I came across an article that said that cataplexy was extremely rare and that most narcoleptics just had these two things and these sleep attacks where they were excessive daytime sleepiness. And when I read that, I just went, oh my God, that's me. And it took several more months to get back in. They sent me back to that same doctor who I told a few things. But I got tested and diagnosed and treated, and now I take medication to stay awake and be alert and function.
Were the hypnagogic hallucinations and sleep paralysis scary? Were they terrifying?
Absolutely. And like I said, that started when I was 13. And because my mother's from the South and there's all sorts of what they call isms there, they thought it was demonic possession.
Which ism does that fall under?
You know, I do not know. But I guess if you have a child who is telling you these things, and, you know, I love my mother very much, but she was intelligent, but very superstitious. And you have to remember that, you know, that was approximately 78. We've had Rosemary's Baby. We've had The Exorcist, this and that. At one point, I did tell somebody at the church. I'm Roman Catholic, and I was involved in CYO, and I had told a youth counselor, and they talked about, they did a little like prayer ceremony over me in church to help remove the devil.
How did you feel about that? Did you think that might have been the cause of what was happening? Because at that point, you didn't really know.
I didn't know. I just knew the next time I had it happen that I thought it didn't work.
Did that scare you even more?
I still can't watch The Entity. Have you ever heard of that movie?
No. Is it like The Exorcist?
It's a little bit different. It's more along the lines of the sleep paralysis with the hallucinations. I guess I did too. I mean, I was a teenager. I thought as well that it was, you know, the devil is after me. I'm so bad. I mean, I didn't have a medical, I didn't have any reason to believe it was something medical. Who heard of something like that?
So once you did get the medicines, has it changed? Has it really alleviated that?
Oh, yeah. I very rarely have that happen. One of the things is learning how to control my environment. Like, I will not try to go to sleep in a dark, quiet room because that could, I could wind up having one. And even though I know what they are now, they're still quite frightening. So I go to sleep listening to a podcast, and I've done that, well, even before I got diagnosed, because I think I just learned that if I'm listening to something else, it's until I pass out, it's helping to keep my mind active, and that staves away the sleep paralysis. But it was very confusing.
A lot of us that don't have hypnagogic hallucinations and sleep paralysis have experienced that thing where you're kind of awake and you're in a dream and you can't get out of it.
Yes.
Maybe you can't run and somebody's after you and you're in the dream and you're stuck right there in the bed and you can't get away from the bad guy.
It is very common for non-narcoleptics to have, you know, a couple of episodes of that. It's just that with me, it was quite severe and continuous. And I don't know, it felt like a deep, dark secret. Like, I can't imagine what it must have been like for people who are like abused or sexually abused. Like, you don't talk about that. Like, that's how it was for me. I didn't talk to people about it. It was, you know, the devil may be after me. I don't know. I was young.
So did you feel more comfortable talking about it once you became an adult, even before it was diagnosed?
Not really, because I didn't know what it was. And I am religious, and I wondered if that's what it was. To the point where once I kind of felt like I knew there was a God, because I felt like I'd experienced the devil. And then once I was diagnosed, it was like, okay, well, now that's not the devil. Do I still feel that there's a God? It really shook me.
How has that shaped your spirituality now? How did you answer that question?
I'm very spiritual, and I believe the answer for me is I don't believe all the dogma of the Catholic Church. I think the traditions are very beautiful. And I believe that the God that I follow in my life is much more of a loving God than a judging God. And he loves me, or I wouldn't still be here getting through everything.
So you did not abandon God after you figured out that the devil was not chasing you?
Correct.
What type of jobs were you able to perform while you were a young adult?
I had jobs that were physical. I worked at the bakery deli in a grocery store because physical jobs kept me from falling asleep. If I had a desk job, it would have been difficult. Anything where I was up and active, and that kept it from happening.
Once it was treated, what did you pursue? A profession? Did you return to school?
I would have loved to. When I was 25, I had my daughter. And once it was treated, it was still very difficult for me to pursue school. My parents lived almost an hour away, so it wasn't like they were an option for childcare. My ex-husband and I didn't have a lot of money. I was a medical assistant for a while. After I got diagnosed, I pursued working for the state at a desk job where I could handle sitting there and using my brain instead of my body for a little bit.
What type of work are you doing, or did you do, for the state?
I started out as an account clerk, and right now I'm an administrative analyst.
What does that really mean?
What that means is I don't do the stuff that our department does. I support the people who do the stuff.
Stuff?
Huh?
What kind of stuff? What department? What kind of things?
I work for Water Resources. I work with a lot of engineers. It means that I am there to buy the computers they need, or get the training they need, or help them with their time or their travel claim, or just make the office run smoothly so they are free to do their job. I am support.
Did you get married?
I did. I got remarried 13 years ago after being a single parent for a very long time. And there is another interesting story in between those two, if you would like it.
Absolutely.
After I was diagnosed and I got my job with the state, there was probably, I'd say, a couple of years of self-actualization. At the same time, my marriage fell apart, so I was a single mother. And, you know, I was going to school while I was working at one class at a time. And I was had a boss that was difficult on me, I felt. And one day I was going to my car to get a book I had in there on cover letters, because I decided I had enough and I was going to go take any other state job at the same level I could just to get away from her. And on my way back, I was hit by a Meals on Wheels driver and thrown 18 feet in the air and landed head first.
Oh, wow. How fast was the car going?
I don't remember how fast the car was going. I just remember seeing him and realizing he wasn't going to stop. And I remember feeling the impact. And I remember just right before I hit the ground, like this mental scream of my daughter's name. And because, you know, is this it? And it was just like this, Crystal. And And that started my next journey of recovery and rehabilitation, because what happened was that gave me a head injury. I went from being a state worker to being on welfare in 6 months, and it took me 6 years to get back to work.
What type of head injury, and how did it affect you?
They call it mild traumatic brain injury. What it did is it caused memory loss, executive function. There's so many things our brain does for us that we don't realize until it gets damaged. You know, when it comes to, you know, getting your car keys or what you're going to have for dinner, or I'm just going to run into the store and grab that. But when your brain gets damaged, my analogy for that was, before I was running track, now I'm running track, but I'm doing it in a foot of Jell-O. So everything I did was that much harder. I could still run the track, but pulling my feet in and out of that Jell-O, it was that much more effort.
Were you still a single parent at this time?
Yes, I was.
So how did you support yourself? You said you went on welfare.
Correct.
Did you lose wherever you were living? Did you have to find a different place to live? Give up your place?
I had to give up my place. I moved in with my sister for a little while. Then I moved in with my ex-mother-in-law while I was dealing with the physical rehabilitation. This was before we even really knew that my head was damaged, because my knee also got blown out in the accident. And still trying to deal with my daughter and get her to school and things like that. I'm actually a fired state worker, which in the state of California, it's almost impossible to fire a state worker. But a deadline was missed for a letter that I was supposed to get to them. So I lost my job and my reinstatement rights. And it took me 6 years to get back there. And for those 6 years, life was very dark and depressing, because I felt like I had been so close to self-actualization, and I had, you know, only several years between being diagnosed as a narcoleptic and having a job where I could use my brain and just feeling like I was ready to take off. And then this happened. And I dealt with quite a bit of depression for a long time.
What happened with your relationship with God then?
It was not great. I've always had my faith, but it just seemed so darn unfair. And I wanted so much for my daughter, and I wasn't able to provide. And, you know, I had nobody to blame but myself for sticking with the depression, I feel like I lived in it. Everything I said, you know, it was the suffix to a sentence or a prefix. And you know, well, this because of the accident and that because of the accident. And it really took one day where I believe I was appealing a Social Security claim, and the person had asked me about my job and the money I was making and where I would be now if this hadn't happened. And I was thinking it through, like my career and my advancement, and realizing I would be so far ahead in my career path. And then at that time, I also found out that even though I was fired, I did still have reinstatement rights with the state. I just had to find somebody willing to hire me at my past classification. And I did that. And it was hard at first because I hadn't worked for 6 years and it was exhausting. And I worked part-time for 3 years as I worked on building my stamina back up. And then I took off again. It's like I didn't want to live in that past anymore. And I wanted to make up to my daughter for all those wasted years. And I promoted, they call it topping out, where you're at the top of your pay scale for your classification. I never reached the top of my pay scale until a couple of years ago. I always promoted. I didn't wait around in that classification. I was just bent on furthering my career as much as possible and as quickly as possible and being the best employee I could while I did that.
Do you feel that you have achieved what you could under the circumstances? Do you feel satisfied with where you are now?
I'm very satisfied. I'm very proud of myself. As you hear where I've been, you know, there's one more level I would have liked to have gone up, but I don't feel the need anymore. My daughter is grown and married. I just became a grandmother. That really changes your priorities a bit. I don't want to try to get to that next level, which is management. I'm really happy just trying to get retired as quickly as possible and spend as much time as I can with that little guy.
Are you still married?
Yes, I am. With my second husband, like I said, we've been together 13 years. I have 3 stepdaughters by him who are all grown and moved away.
When did you meet during this journey of yours?
No, it was probably midway. And I met him from a friend of a friend. And turns out he used to live down the street from me. And we hit it off. And he's been a real blessing in my life.
What do you like to do in your spare time other than genealogy?
Other than genealogy, I love to camp. We bought a trailer last year before COVID hit, and we've got to take that out quite a few times. There's a lot of crafts I would like to learn, but I don't have time right now. I'm much better at buying craft supplies than using them. But one day when I retire, those crafts are all going to be used, or my grandson and I are really going to enjoy them. I'm an avid thrift shopper. That is how I decompress.
Other than your Revolutionary War patriot, are there any other family stories or oral history that really resonate with you?
The oral history, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of oral history passed down in my family. There was my mother talking about being Indian in the family, and prior to DNA, you know, and once I started getting into genealogy, it's like everybody says they have Indian in their family. It really is like the number one thing. Well, once I got into genealogy, which was, you know, courtesy of one of my cousins and her husband, who really helped me start focusing on my mother's side of the family, found out there was a Dawes file, which Dawes was the commission that put together the 5 civilized tribes back in 1900-something. But there, my mother's family had all applied for the Dawes Commission to become members of the Choctaw Nation. They were all denied because they didn't have evidence, but there was all sorts of wonderful stuff in those applications. And you know, whether they were denied or not, once I pieced that together with eventually also taking my DNA, yeah, it's true. I'm 13% Native American. So it lines up with what was talked about in the Dawes file, which I found really interesting. also, and it's not family lore, it's just more stuff that came down afterwards. I found out via doing my DNA from a genealogist who's the administrator that I am a Georgetown University 272 descendant. And that was wonderful news to get. The genealogy nerd in me really loved, because what that did is break a brick wall that we couldn't get through. And this genealogist just took me back 150 years.
Explain it to me. What does that mean?
Well, the Georgetown 272 are slaves that were sold in Maryland, because prior to being Georgetown University, the college was in trouble and the Jesuits needed to raise money. So they sold these slaves down south and used the proceeds from that sale to build up the college. There's a lot of controversy about that now and amends and all that. But initially, when I found out, I was not interested in that part of it at all. It was just, oh my God, you have all these records and you broke a brick wall. So they have traced, I now know which one of the Georgetown 272 I descend from. And it's just, it's wonderful having all that information.
So these were enslaved Africans?
Yes.
And so you traced back to your African ancestry through this Georgetown 272.
Well, some of it. I've also, through the other side, on my paternal side, both my parents have African American in them. So but the 272, genealogists, we always want to go farther back. And, you know, we had been able to get to, I think, my great-grandmother, and then it stopped. And the cousin who was even more into genealogy than me had gone back there and was looking at records, and just the trail was cold. And with triangulating DNA, the genealogist was able to match me up. And I'm so thrilled that I took that test, because, yeah, it's very interesting having more of that, those ancestors, and finding out the history of how they wound up in Louisiana, and just having more of the information. With the genealogy on my father's side, there was just one or two connections that needed to be made. And that took us all the way back to my patriot and my patriot's, got DAR says concubine. I don't want to say that. When my father went to visit his cousin and had this little bit of knowledge that one of my cousin's husbands had gathered, he just had to make a couple of connections when he was in Louisiana, and the rest was already there. It was a very odd experience, especially after the way it was growing up and not knowing anything. He comes back and says, well, there's this book. There's a book? There's a book about our family? Yeah. It turns out that our family was pretty famous, and that our grandmother was this amazing woman. And I just say grandmother, I'm not going to count generations. And it was so surreal and fabulous at the same time. Yeah, I wish I would have known all this stuff when I was younger. But that whole sense of not belonging that I talked about as a child. My maiden name is Rock. We say Roque out here. Back in Louisiana, they say Rock. There is a house with our name on it by the river in this town. And this book that chronicles our family's story. And it was fascinating. So there was no real need to hire a genealogist because God blessed Gary Mills and his wife, Elizabeth Schoen Mills, that have spent so much time getting all the details and putting it in a book, Forgotten People. It was Dr. Mills' dissertation, which was put into a novel, and his wife updated it about 9 years ago. So there's even more to it now. But after having not known much about my ancestors or feeling much culture at all, it was an explosion, and it was just fabulous.
What did you learn from the book? Who were your ancestors? What were their names?
Well, this book chronicles the descendants of Claude Thomas Pierre Matoyer and his concubine, that is Quan Quan, also known as Marie Therese. And she was enslaved. Her parents were enslaved and came from Africa. That's where we trace back to Ghana. And because the Mills had spent so much time going over all these records, we had, you know, dates and lineage, and they were, Quan Quan was just a fascinating woman. And she went from being enslaved to being a slave owner and buying the freedom of all her children.
How did she obtain the capability to do that?
Well, she was in a relationship with Claude Thomas. That is who she had some of her children by. She had also had children previous to him that were enslaved from another relationship. And when the French were in control in Louisiana, there was more freedom for the enslaved to have outside projects and things where they could earn money and they could use that money to buy their freedom or the freedom of their children. And that was her life's goal and her life's work. Unfortunately, in attaining all that, she did own slaves and use their labor to buy the freedom of her children. But as I said before, I try not to judge the people in the past because I didn't live there. But from the documentation, she did treat people very well. It was more like family, but still exploitation. And that was, I think, out of all of it, it was fabulous finding out that there was a book and we had this great lineage and there's a church and a mansion and all this. When I found out that I was the descendant of an African American who owned slaves, that was a hard one to swallow. I assumed I would be the descendant of a slave owner because we know that many women did not have choice in who they slept with, but I assumed that I would be the descendant of a white slave owner. And it took me back. And, you know, there was a lot to digest there because I didn't know that there had been any African Americans who own slaves. So we're not taught that in school, although she's not that rare. There's many others.
How did you process that?
You know, it almost seemed, I don't know, just so wrong, like cannibalism. Like, how could you do this? You were a slave. But getting back to that spirituality thing, my best friend Becky, I was telling her about it, and she said, you know, there's slavery in the Bible. It's as old as time. She's not doing anything that many people before her didn't do. And somehow that made me feel better, because we think of it just being this American tradition and that we're the only ones who have ever done this. And it goes back, you know, eons and eons that people have been enslaved. And I don't know why, but that did make me feel better.
What about the part where you said that she helped her family by owning slaves and she treated them well? Did you get any kind of feeling that by her owning these slaves, she was actually protecting them? They had to have some place to go. Did it come across in your research or your readings that she was actually doing something beneficial for them to kind of have a safe harbor for them?
Well, in the books, it's obvious from the way the Mills write about her, they have a lot of affection for her as a person and everything they found out. I think that probably being owned by her was better than being owned by a lot of people, but you're still owned, which is a horrible thing.
Tell me about the gentleman that she was with, Claude Thomas Pierre Metoyer.
Claude Thomas Pierre Metoyer was the son of a French merchant who came over, I'm assuming for some kind of adventure, and came to Natchitoches and wound up hiring Marie Therese away from Madame Saint Denis, who was her owner, to be his housekeeper. And what has been written in the book is that it was a love match. They fell in love. It was not like so many of our ancestors were forced into these situations, that there was great affection between the two. And they were together for a very long time, and I believe had 8 children together before he wound up having to marry a white woman so he could have an acceptable family and children to leave his property to. It's also says in the book that those families knew about each other and helped each other, that it wasn't, you know, like the uppity, we're looking down on you. It sounds like there was a lot of cooperation.
How does this connect to the Creole lineage of your parents?
Well, Creole in our definition today is anyone who identifies with that culture and has that any mixture of African American, Spanish, French, and Indian. The food is handed down. The traditions are handed down. You know, it's so hard to define Creole because it's kind of abstract in some ways. But today, it definitely is who I am.
How are your parents both related to the Creole community? I don't understand. If they're from Mississippi and New York, how are they both Creole? And how did they meet outside of the Creole community and just so happen to both be Creole?
My father's family left Natchitoches, and this is all stuff I found out after, around the Depression for the job opportunities that were available in New York. And it wasn't just his immediate family. It was like, I'm sure you've heard about the diaspora where many African Americans wound up in Chicago or in Los Angeles because they were getting away from the South. They just happened to go to New York. But my grandmother was from Louisiana, and my grandfather was born in Natchitoches, where Claude Thomas and Quan Quan are from, and you know, had all those wonderful foods and traditions. And even though it was different kinds of Creole.
This is your father's side.
Yes.
With Marie Therese and Claude Thomas Pierre Matoire.
Correct.
And how did my mother, how did she get Creole heritage?
Well, her mother was from Louisiana. And I think I would definitely say my dad's more Creole than my mom. And perhaps it's a way of explaining dark skin without saying African American. I don't know. But my mother, she did identify. I mean, I remember those wonderful stealing shrimp out of my granny's shrimp and grits she had in the fridge. It was that kind of food and cooking. And
so your mother's family was from Louisiana. What part?
My mother's mother was born in New Orleans, and her mother was born in, I'm going to say this wrong, Lafourche, I believe they say, Louisiana. And the man she married is the grandson of one of the GU-272. And I believe Matilda Verrett was also born in Louisiana. You know, I think
who was Matilda?
Matilda would be my mother's grandmother.
Do you know the name of the enslaved person that you descend from the Georgetown 272?
The original slave was named Harriet. That was sold down south. And I couldn't go through the whole thing, but the last enslaved person was Mary Mahoney. And Mary Mahoney, I'm not sure if there was a marriage or not, but she was with a man named Samuel Johnson. And Johnson is the last name of my mother's mother. And I also discovered several years ago that my grandfather was killed on a boat in New Orleans. He worked as a longshoreman or something like that. And there were some kind of fumes that came from below deck. And he went down to help somebody else, and five people died, and they never identified what those fumes were, including him. It's interesting finding these stories, the triumphs as well as the tragedies.
Is that your maternal or paternal grandfather?
That would be my maternal. And, you know, it's so funny. My mom used to tell me these things like, well, you know, all those Creoles moved here from Louisiana. And when I was a kid, I thought, well, what, like they all got together and decided to come out? It made no sense to me because there's
California.
There was a huge Creole community in Los Angeles. But
is that where your parents met?
My parents met in Pasadena, which is where my mother's family moved to from Mississippi.
Is Pasadena, does that have a huge Creole community there? Like, how did the two Creoles meet out in Pasadena?
I don't know if they have a huge Creole community per se, but Los Angeles did. And yeah, I never understood how all the Creoles wound up there. Like, I met the man who owned Pete's Louisiana Hot Sausage one time, and he talked about playing in kindergarten with my grandmother in Louisiana. And that just seemed so weird. And you both wound up here in inner city Los Angeles. God, how did my parents meet? I should know this. That's terrible. I just know that at one point my father was in the seminary, and having a father who was going to be a father is a unique thing. But I don't believe my mother is the reason he did not stay in the seminary.
Tell me about your Revolutionary War patriot.
That's Claude Thomas Pierre Matoire, who goes by Pierre.
When did you find out that he was a Revolutionary War ancestor? When did you find out that he contributed to the American Revolution? And how did you find out? And when you did, how did that make you feel?
There is a Facebook group for those of us that are descendants of Pierre and Quang Quang. And there had been some things put about he was going to be, there was going to be a grave marker put on his grave, and he was being honored for his patriotic service during the American Revolution, and that any of us descendants, as long as we could come up with the documentation, would be eligible for the SAR and the DAR. And that was 2011.
SAR meaning Sons of the American Revolution?
Sons of the American Revolution.
And DAR, Daughters of the American Revolution?
Correct. I thought that was a nice honor for him, but it wasn't going to affect me because why would I want to join DAR? I mean, I knew what DAR was. That's all those white women who wouldn't let Marian Anderson sing. So that is not for me.
So how did you kind of reconcile that? You pursued membership?
I did. You know, after my daughter got married and I knew that there that chapter of my life was closing, that, you know, planning the wedding and all that, I'm sure anybody who's dealt with that knows what I mean. But when that's over, she's now a wife and going on her journey. She doesn't need me like she used to. And that was going to free up some time. And what did I want to do with it? One of the podcasts I listened to is Bernice Bennett. And she had on a guest who was a woman of color and talked about joining a lineage society to help with your genealogical research. And I knew I was eligible. And I did not see where DAR could possibly help with my lineage because it's a bunch of white women. But I thought, you know what? Why not? Why not? Since you have the time, do this. It'll be kind of cool. There's a certain cachet about saying I'm a DAR. You know, and if you don't like it, then you don't stay with it. So I, like the week after my daughter's wedding, I sent the email and started the process, met with the lady. She was very nice. I didn't feel judged or, you know, I didn't get that vibe from her at all. And I continued with my application and started going to meetings as a prospective member. All the ladies were very sweet, and I really liked it. The history in the presentations really appealed to the nerd in me, because I am a self-proclaimed nerd. And there were, you know, every presentation program wasn't about history, but the ones that were just fascinating. And I decided, you know, I've always been patriotic. I like doing things for vets. You know, it sounded like we had much more in common than our differences. And I really wanted, by the time my application was approved, I really wanted to be a member. It did take a while. Most African Americans have a problem with membership because of records. And as the generations get older, that was not my case. Once again, thanks to Elizabeth Bishon Mills and Gary Mills, so much of it was done for me. My hiccup became my great-grandmother in New York, who I could not get a death certificate for. And I spent probably over a year trying to get that information. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the group Reclaim the Records. They fight all these states and governments that want to charge and keep these things hidden that should be public record and public information, or charge exorbitant fees for it. They won the case to get the index for the New York City death index. And as soon as I heard that, I went to the website, in under a minute, I had her, because last name Rock, it's R-O-Q-U-E. 9 times out of 10, if it gets misspelled, it's R-O-G-U-E. There are other misspellings, but that's usually the one. And there she was. And I had that certificate in less than a month. And I was so excited. Other things in working on the application, I was prompted. One of the issues my mother had is she didn't have a birth certificate. I don't know what happened to it or why she grew up without one, but she didn't have a birth certificate. She also wasn't quite positive who her father was, because the man that she suspected was her father passed away when she was an infant. So there was like some speculation about, you know, could he have fathered this child? And I don't know, family gossip. Anyway, I had to get my mother's birth certificate to join DAR. So I got into action. I wrote Mississippi, where she's from, said this is where her family was. And they offer that they'll check surrounding counties and things like that. I said, I know it's this county. Don't bother checking any other counties. And I gave them every one of her siblings that was born there and said, there's a misspelling because it's got to be there. And her maiden name was Narcisse, N-A-R-C-I-S-S-E. About 6 weeks later, I got a birth certificate in the mail for an M-A-U-R-I-C-E. They had butchered her last name, so it was never able to be found. But because I had given the siblings, somehow they were able in the index to come up with it. That was really meaningful, because as somebody without a birth certificate, my mother could not ever have state ID. She could not leave the country. She could not vote. There are so many things. And, you know, my mother didn't drive. Even if my mother wanted to drive, she couldn't have driven because she couldn't get the driver's license. I just wish to God she'd still been alive to see that I had it, that it named the man that, you know, her, who she thought was her father, as her father. Once I got his death certificate, it also became apparent that it was a sudden illness, not that he had been bedridden for several years, like what was a rumor. And then eventually did the DNA, and I match my cousins right where I should be, so I could tell her who she was. I wish I could have given her that gift.
This came about through your research in applying for the Daughters of the American Revolution?
Yes, it did.
So do you consider that the DAR has somehow impacted your life?
Oh, yes.
In what way?
Well, finding those things, finding the certificates, getting more into the family heritage as I had to come up with all this documentation. And I know I like being a member of DAR. I think we do a lot of really good things. And, you know, they've also made sure that I don't get bored, which I don't think is a word I've ever used as an adult. I've got plenty to do, especially now that I'm on the board of my local chapter. I'm in California. Sacramento, California.
It's very interesting that you decided to join a chapter where you live now, which is customary, but there's a host of descendants from Claude Thomas Pierre Matoire in a chapter in Louisiana. Why did you not feel compelled to join that chapter with a lot of your relatives that maybe you do or don't know?
I joined the Sacramento chapter before they formed the Cane River chapter, but I was thrilled to death when they got their charter and their group together. It has been my intention to become an associate member of that chapter because, yeah, it is, it's Cane River. And yeah, I would love
Cane to. Cane River is, what does that mean to you?
Cane River is the river, well, now it's Cane River Lake, but it is the river in Natchitoches where Pierre Matoire and Quang Quang once lived and were there. And you know, that's such a great chapter name too. I'm so jealous. But I do want to become an associate member of that chapter. I just haven't gotten around to it. I do know some of the women through Facebook that are in that chapter. And I was really thrilled that they got together. But I look forward to seeing some of those women sometime. Maybe I will make it out to Washington, D.C. one of these days. And when we have the Continental Congress.
The annual national conference for the DAR. You're hoping to meet them there when they may travel to Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Or I'll just go out to Natchitoches again.
So you have visited Natchitoches before?
I have been there twice, yes.
Have you ever met any of the other Matoires that are members of the DAR?
I don't believe so. I almost feel like when you go to Natchitoches, you should wear a t-shirt that says, I'm a Matoire descendant, are you? Just so people will identify. Because they are everywhere. There's estimated 10,000 of us that descend from that one union.
Wow. So how does it feel to be in a society that has multiple descendants of your patriot?
It's pretty awesome. I don't feel like nothing. Oh, that's a double negative, isn't it? But, you know, as I said earlier, in childhood, it kind of felt like nothing. I wasn't African-American. I wasn't white. It's a great sense of belonging.
In your chapter, you said that you're now on the board. What position do you hold?
I am the corresponding secretary.
You must feel very embraced by your chapter members who have voted you to be a chapter officer and on the board of the chapter as a woman of color.
Yes, I do. It has not been an issue at all. There may be one or two there that have a problem with it, but they have not revealed themselves to me. And, you know, mostly I just really enjoy the ladies. There's a lot of history there. You know, one other thing. When we talk about DAR and I joined, my father, who was getting up in years, he'd say things like, so have you gone to any of those racist meetings yet? Because he wasn't thrilled with it. Well, you know, my father died right before COVID hit. And his funeral was rather small because we moved up here. He's got a huge family, but everybody's in Southern California or Los Angeles or Louisiana. And it was small and it was kind of sad. But you know who showed up at that funeral? DAR. I had about five of my DAR sisters show up there, and I didn't even tell people. I guess somebody had seen it on my Facebook feed.
These are the women that your father felt were the racist women, this meeting that you're going to that he, I guess, never accepted. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yes.
But they showed up for his
they did
service.
And I felt very cared for that they had come. Yeah, that's a pretty big impact to my life. It was just nice to have the support.
How did you reconcile these misgivings that he had about the organization?
You know, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I know that the world that my parents grew up in is not the world I grew up in. That the racism they both experienced is so much different. You know, it's like my father's DD-214. He was in the military. I got it. And you can see where somebody has changed the race on his DD-214, because I guess somebody must have thought he was white, so they changed it to colored. You know, that was the world they lived in. And I can understand some of that, holding on to some of that. You don't ever let it go. I'm just really glad that the world's a different place today.
So you choose not to look at it the same way your parents do because it's a different time?
Yes. You know, I try to go by Dr. King, content of the character, not the color of the skin. And that goes for everybody.
What does being a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution mean to you?
It means that I am a part of something bigger than myself, and I get lots of opportunity to honor people from the past and help people in the present. And I get to have fun doing it.